I want to get into today are some more connectedness concepts. So there's kind of a hierarchy of properties. Various stronger notions of connectedness. It's kind of like when we had the stuff about matrizability, first countability, second countability, and how they interacted. There's some implications, and some things didn't imply each other. There's some kind of hierarchy here. So there's a kind of a very strong property, which is being a convex subspace of Rn. I'll just say subset, that's sufficient. That's very strong. Does anybody know what this means? Have you seen that concept before?
Thank you.
It means between any two points you can draw a straight line without leaving the set. So, let's see. So, like, the interior of an ellipse, for example, is convex because any two points inside the ellipse, you can draw a straight line between them and you never leave the ellipse. An annulus is not convex because here we have a set inside of ellipse. If you have an annulus where there's a hole, right, then you can have two points, but if you try and draw the straight line between them, you have to leave the set. Now, if you are a convex subset, that makes things very nice. It implies it implies connectedness, but it implies some additional kinds of connectedness. It implies a strong form of connectedness called path connectedness. A path is a generalization of a straight line, so we'll get that in there. And it also implies local connectedness. Okay. Obviously, if you have both of these properties, then trivially you could just forget about one of them and say, I guess I'm going to leave off the NES. Let's just say path connected and local connected and locally connected. So any topological space can have these two properties. They're more general. They make sense even if you're not a subset of a Euclidean space. Okay? Path connected, in turn, is strong enough to imply connected. However, locally connected does not imply connected, and even path connected does not imply locally connected. So you can't really improve on this diagram here of implications. Okay. Okay. So let me write down some formal definitions here. Okay, so let's remember a topological space. Topological space, we have a set and a topology on the set is... It's connected if what? If there are no non-trivial Clopen sets. Path connected looks very different. But I'll show you how there's a connection between them. So path connected says if for all A and B in X, there is a path from A to B. Well, what's a path? Says that there's a continuous function from the closed interval 0, 1 to x. Okay. And you can think of it, maybe think of this as an interval of time. So you, at time 0, you're at A, at time 1, you're at B. If you think of a subset of Euclidean space like this annulus here, it's very easy to imagine, say, a path from here to here, right? Like, if this was A and this was B, although the straight line leaves the annulus, I could think of a simple parametrically defined curve, maybe something that goes to the right until, say, t equals a half, and then it goes... You know, in this example, I could just go straight up after that, right? So this annulus here is actually path connected because for any two points, actually, you could draw, and you couldn't get from one point to the other with just one line segment without leaving the annulus. But if you're allowed two or three line segments, you should be able to find a path from A point, no problem. So not only is it path connected, but you can have very simple polygonal paths in this example. So that's why path connected, I guess that shows that path connected doesn't imply convex. So there's a general trick in topology where you want to say that if you have some global property like connectedness, you want to localize it by saying for every point there's some kind of neighborhood around that point that is that has that property as a subspace. So here you'd want to say something like, for every point, you basically want to say there's a connected neighborhood. That seems to be a little bit too strong. What you want is...
So, because, let me put this.
You want to make it really local. You want to actually be able to shrink stuff down. So, it's not too strong, it's too weak, okay? It's kind of a trivial sense in which every point has a connected neighborhood. If, say, the whole space is connected, then the whole space would be one big neighborhood. You want it to be local, so you want every neighborhood to actually contain a smaller thing with the property. So it goes like this. So you'd have something like this. For all P in X, for all open U containing P, you want to shrink down to something smaller. Okay. So you want there exists a C connected subset of U, and you want it to be a neighborhood of P. So, in other words, you want P to be in the interior. This is kind of a general scheme. You can talk about any property, not just connectedness, and you can localize it by saying, okay, for every point and every open set around that point, I should be able to shrink down to a smaller thing that's still a neighborhood of the point, but has whatever property I'm interested in as a subspace. So this one is a little bit trickier to understand. I can give you an example of something that's... Well, first of all, let me notice that here, like this one and this one are both locally connected. In fact, the idea is... let's see one way things can go right is when you have these kinds of things. Imagine a point P, and you imagine some open U around it. Well, in Euclidean space, every open set U contains a ball, right? So just have a ball with center P, and that'll be connected. In fact, it'll be convex. Same thing works over here. I have some whatever kind of weird open set I have here. I mean, it doesn't even have to be a connected open set, right? It could be an open set that has like kind of other parts that I don't care about, but I could still shrink down to some little disk C. That would do the job. As long as P is in the interior of that disk, these two-dimensional cases. You could even make up, as I said with this scheme, you could talk about some related local property, locally path connected, right? It'd be exactly the same formalism. Now you would demand that for any open set around P, you could find a path-connected neighborhood of P that fit inside that open set. And if you have an n-dimensional open ball, right, which in two dimensions, that's just an open disk, well, any two points inside the disk, you can draw a straight line between them. So, actually, what you have here is something even better than local path connectedness. You actually have local convexity. Right? So, because around, in these two examples, so these are actually even better than locally connected or locally path connected. They're actually locally convex. Now, locally convex doesn't make sense for a general topological space because for a general topological space, there's no notion of, you know, a straight line. But you see the local concept, you know, for any point, for any open set around the point, you can shrink down to a smaller neighborhood of the point that has whatever property you're demanding, in this case, convexity. So in these examples are both locally convex, hence locally path connected, hence locally connected, right? So if you wanted over here, you could have, you know, more to the diagram, right? You could have locally path connected, and then another one, locally convex. Because the implications here, you just localize them. You talk about subspaces. Now, to see the difference between these local things and the global form, you have to think of something a little bit weirder. So a classic example is the topologist's sine curve. There's another example, it's basically, it's called like a topologist's broom, or a broom. So let me read. So for example, here's the topologist's sine curve. You have a vertical interval in the plane, and it's a subset of the y-axis. So like right here is x-coordinate 0, y-coordinate negative 1. Up here is x-coordinate 0, y-coordinate 1. But then you add more to this subspace of the plane. You throw in something that will basically wiggle more and more. All right. So it's basically an oscillating curve that, in a sense, converges to this line segment, but in a tricky way. So let's see here. So it's, what you do is you just take the curve, which looks roughly like this. It's given by y equals sine 1 over x. Okay, so this is the topologist's sine curve. We could write it out as, say, this part here, the line segment part that you tack on, you'd have that. Then you have the union of all points of the form x, comma, sine of 1 over x, where x is a positive real. So the problem with these oscillations is so if you had a point P here, you could imagine, you know, various neighborhoods. Now remember, we're in the subspace here, so a neighborhood
an open set around P, it could look something like this, right? And it could have some, you know, unneeded garbage that we don't care about like that. You know, it could have extra pieces to it that we don't really want. But we could certainly shrink down to just an actual open interval, say C, right? A little bit of arc there. And that would be a connected neighborhood of P. But if you're looking at a point P over here, right? And so think a little bit carefully about what would a neighborhood of P look like? What would an open set around P look like in a subspace? So open sets of the plane are unions of disks, unions of open disks, right? So in the subspace topology, an open set is an open disk, or more generally a union of open disks, intersected with our topologist's sine curve here. So like each of these arcs, right, is actually a union of open disks intersected with this curve. All right, so you could imagine, you know, some open disk, say here, right? That could be a simple kind of neighborhood for P. Right? It'd be an open set around P, just one open disk. Right? We don't even need a bunch. Right? And so you'd have, so once you intersected with the curve, you'd have something like this. Now the problem is, all these oscillations in red are going up and down and up and down, right? The sine curve, see, it's going all the way down to negative 1, all the way back up to 1, over and over and over again. Okay? So if you look at this neighborhood, if you have a neighborhood around P that's small enough, then you look at each of all of these pieces there, and they're not connected to each other. And shrinking to some smaller C won't help, right? You could imagine, okay, well, I'll shrink to, you know, something smaller around C. There's, you know, some smaller C around here. You know, something like that, right? But it's not connected because you're always going to have infinitely many little oscillations there. So this thing is actually connected. In fact, well, okay. It's this one's pretty weird. So this one is actually connected, but it's not locally connected. And it's not path connected. Right. You have all these disconnected pieces here, and shrinking down to smaller disks doesn't help. Nor would it help to shrink down to a union of smaller disks. Right? Once you intersect with the curve, you're always going to have these disconnected pieces whenever you're looking at neighborhoods of a point P here on the far left segment. And even worse or better, depending how you think about it, it's not path connected, because say I wanted to go from here to here with a continuous function from the closed interval 0, 1. Right? You want to have a path that went from here to here. Okay, ask yourself what happens with the y-coordinate. Okay? Well, if this is y-coordinate 0 over here, say, then if the path goes from left to right, then as the time approaches 1, the y-coordinate of our path would have to converge to this y-coordinate, right? But it can't do that because it has to keep going up and down between 1 and negative 1, right? if you just look at the x components, you see that by the intermediate value theorem, it can't skip over, right, an arc. Its x values have to go everywhere, right? So let's draw another picture then. So maybe that one point is the origin. Okay. And then we've got these oscillations between y equals 1 and y equals negative 1. Okay. And then you've got, something way out there, right? Let's call it A and sine of 1 over A, right? A is greater than 0. And now you try to imagine a continuous function to this space. So what is it? As I said, so I can call the topologist sine curve. Okay. Now, since the output is always going to be of the form an x coordinate comma a y coordinate, I'm going to write it like this. Okay, I'll write it as f comma g. So the f will tell you the x coordinate of an output, and the g will tell you the y-coordinate of an output. So suppose we have just a continuous parametric curve in the plane, starts at time 0, goes to time 1, and the starting point, the starting output, is there. So f of 0 is equal to a, f of 1 is equal to 0, and then in terms of the y-coordinates, it's got to start here, so that's sine of 1 over a, and then when you get to the end time 1, it's going all the way back over here to 0, say. All right. Okay. So the limit as t approaches 1 from the left, of course, so as we get up to time 1, the path, whatever it does, if it's really going to converge to this point and the limit as t approaches 1, right, it's got to be, by continuity, it's got to go to the actual value, g of 1, which is 0. Okay, so that means we can choose a delta positive such that once you're close enough to time 1, all the y-coordinates are somewhat close to 0. So how about between negative a half and a half? Because the y-coordinate is converging to 0, so eventually it stops being further than one half away from 0. So now we're in here. So eventually the path has to commit to a y-coordinate here if there really is such a path. All right? Well, now what you do is you choose. You just need to choose points. You just need to find where the path is way over here, where the oscillations are happening so fast that say you're here, right, along the path, and you want to eventually get over there. So that means later, you're over here,
So you would have to do something like this. Right? That would be, somehow you'd have, that's the only way you could get over there. Right? But that would throw you out of the allowed range of y coordinates. You'd have to do something like that. Now, more formally, the way we get that is it's not just the g, right? It's also the f, the x coordinate of the outputs. Okay. So if you make the delta small enough, you can also get those x coordinates to be really close together. So, basically, how about f of t is less than or equal to something small here? So, like, it doesn't have to be that small. But the point is, we want it to be. I mean, way out here. When 1 over x is hardly changing because x is big, there's no oscillations. We need to start oscillating, okay? So think about the function. It's gonna, the first time it crosses 0, say, is at pi, or really 1 over pi, which is the reciprocal. So you could have something like this. How about less than 1 over pi? So you do something like this. So you let you pick something like, say, we'll call this t0, which is in here but not at the end yet. So how about 1 minus delta over 2? Okay. So maybe this right here is f comma g of t0. Now, it could be way over, right? So you just want to choose n such that what? So we know that every time the 1 over x increments by another multiple of pi, we have to do another oscillation, either up to positive 1 or down to negative 1. So you have, so wherever this is, it's going to be something like this. So when you plug in 1 over n pi, right, for an x value, when you plug for a time value, you plug that in, right, to here, and then you take the reciprocal and you get n pi, and the sign of that is 0. But now what we can do is then you can choose another delta, delta prime or whatever. Such that, basically you just want to get even closer. So what we want to have is some point like this, basically you want to, so here you're at time t equals t0, then over here you want to be at t equals t1, you want to be forced to have gone outside the y bounds. So you choose some delta prime positive such that for all t in 1 minus delta prime to 1, now
if you wait longer, it's, since the x-coordinate is supposed to be converging to zero, you can get the x-coordinates even closer. Right? So how about... have them all less than 1 over n plus 2 times pi, say. Okay. Like that. So you get another oscillation. At least one, right? So, so let T1 be, say, 1 minus the delta prime over 2. Okay. And then you have, then you've got this problem where time between T0 and T1. Right, so if you look at the f values, these x-coordinate outputs, you've gone from something smaller than 1 over n plus 2 pi by the time you're at T1, and then, but on the other hand, T0 is something bigger than 1 over n plus 1 pi. So there has to be an intermediate time when you were at 1 over n plus, say, 3 halves pi. Okay. And let's see here. We should make the, we should put one other condition. I want that delta prime to be no larger than delta, so that we really are going to be, you know, moving, time is going to keep going forward, so that we're going to keep the y bounds, right? If, as long as I make this delta prime no bigger than delta, then my y bounds here are good for this interval too. Okay? Now, in this subspace, if you plug in, right, if you have such and such an x-coordinate, then your y-coordinate is related to it by this formula, as long as your x-coordinate is positive. So this implies that if you look at the y-coordinate, it has to be the sine of the reciprocal of this, which would be the sine of a odd multiple of half of pi, and that's always going to be plus or minus 1. So that's the contradiction. Because you'll end up with something like this, where you're too high. Contradicts our earlier thing that for all t sufficiently close to 1, the y-coordinate is less than a half away from 0. So if you try to, if you say, okay, imagine there is a path, you get to a contradiction. Why is this connected, though? That that argument is much easier. Before I go to that, are there any questions about this proof by contradiction here?
Why do you say choose the delta bigger than zero such that any t in the interval 50 bigger than 1 over minus 1 over 2 less than 1 over 2? What do you mean? This is an assumption?
Well, if the function is continuous, then as time approaches 1, the y-coordinate has to approach 0 if it's really a path from here to the origin. Okay?
Yeah, yes.
So just by continuity, right, I can get that, right? I mean, we're talking about a continuous function from a interval of reals into the plane, okay? So you can just think continuity as you do in calculus, right? It's the same. If you just think about it, purely topologically, I could draw a disk of radius 1/2 around the origin and intersect it with my subspace. And the pre-image of that disk has to be open by continuity. Hence, it has to contain a neighborhood of time 1. Right? So that would mean that there has to be a neighborhood, which I could shrink down to something of this form, of time 1, that gets mapped into a disk of radius 1/2 around the origin. Right? Hence, it would have to have y-coordinates between -1/2 and +1/2. Open continuity means open sets of open pre-images. So time 1 is in the pre-image of this point. So there has to be a whole neighborhood of time 1 in the pre-image of a neighborhood around this point. In other words, there has to be a whole neighborhood of time 1 that gets mapped into a neighborhood around this point. One such neighborhood is just a disk of radius 2, or sorry, radius 1/2. Also, a neighborhood is literally everything with y coordinate between -1/2 and 1/2. There's a number of ways you can think about it. Is that what you were asking about? The reason we can choose the delta is because it's continuous. It's continuous, and the output for time 1 is over here. And the version of continuity we've defined is really equivalent to the kind you see in calculus. So you can really just think about it this way. Limit as t approaches 1 of the x-coordinate and y-coordinates of the function are each going to 0.
And the choice of half and -1/2 was arbitrary, right? It could have been a third and a negative a third.
Yeah, yeah.
Anything between 1 and -1.
Right, right. As long as I get a contradiction from it being +/-1 over there. Yeah. Could have been 0.99 and -0.7.
Yeah. You would still find your contradiction.
Right? Yeah. Other questions? This is how I would try to formalize my claim that it's not path connected. You can do a similar write-up if you're trying to formalize non-local connectedness. It just boils down to saying, if you look at any little neighborhood around a point on the far left,
It's got a bunch of disconnected pieces, right? So you can't have a path that goes through all of them. Likewise, you can't have an actual connected neighborhood either, because there's always a little piece.
But why is it connected? That's the other part. Okay, so the key is that it's got a dense connected subspace. Okay? That's the key. Right? In other words, the closure of this thing is the whole thing. And if you ask what are the limit points of this wave here that oscillates with increasing frequency as we get really close to this interval, the only limit points that aren't already in the set are what you get by getting closer and closer to x coordinate 0, which you can do because this wave just keeps going up and down and gets closer and closer and closer. And so you can get every y-coordinate because for any y-coordinate you care about, you can just draw a line through that y-coordinate. And there's a horizontal line. So, if you want to get to here, you just draw a line. So you can get it all. Why don't I draw a picture of that? Not to, I don't want to crowd that up. So here you have this. And oscillations that go on forever. So for any y coordinates that you're interested in, so you have x coordinate 0 and some target y coordinate, you just imagine a little draw horizontal line, and you can just have a sequence from this part, the wave, right? Every time these waves hit that horizontal line, you can get a bunch of points. So you can just take the limit of this sequence, right? And it's going to converge to there. So you have this thing here. You get this line segment in the closure. Okay? And so in general, if X is a space, topological space in general, and let's say you have A subset of B, and B is a subset of A closure, let's just keep it simple, okay? If X is a space, and C is a connected subset of X, then C closure is connected. There's a slightly more complicated version of this statement, but it's good enough. The reason this works is that you'd work it backwards basically. If C closure was disconnected, then you could use the witness of that, then shrink things down to C by throwing away any limit points you need to throw away to get back to C, and it would still be disconnected. So that's called proving the contrapositive. Right? The way the proof works is, that's the format of the argument. most connectedness proofs are like that. You assume that something is disconnected, and you prove that something else is disconnected. That's usually that's usually easier than working directly from connectedness.
That's the format of the proof. Got the homework handout, right? There's one little typo in that it should be a row at the end of problem number one, not a D. Here, I'll pass it around. If you read the problem, you know, it'll probably be obvious what I meant, but in case it's not, go through that proof, okay? Somehow, like, C has got two parts to it, or C closure has two parts to it. And, okay, so that means it's disconnected in the subspace topology, okay? So that means there exists A, B, disjoint, non-empty Clopen subsets of C closure. But what does Clopen mean, right? It means Clopen in the subspace topology for C, right? For C closure. You gotta be careful there. So disjoint non-empty Clopen sets such that. So you'd have two parts to C, say, like this. A, or C closure, rather. Now, okay. Now, what do you do? Well, how about you just let F equal C intersect A, and G equal C intersect B. So the difference between C closure and C is just, you know, some limit points in there. Okay.
Now, this is starting to get delicate because there's kind of three different topologies you could be thinking about now. You can think about the subspace C, the subspace C closure, and the whole space X. Okay. All right. So for example, this C here, this is the closure in X. Okay. It's not the closure of C in itself, because that wouldn't be that's not what we're after, right? Now here, let's see. Are F and G closed? Are these closed in C? Okay, so the closure in C of F. What is that? Well, that's just going to be the closure in C bar of F intersected with C.
Okay.
Well, F is a subset of A. A is closed because it's clopen. The closure is the smallest closed superset of something, so this is certainly contained in A intersects C, which is equal to F. Okay. But actually, containment is all you need, right? Because a closure only adds points; it never takes points away. Okay, so actually, the F is its own closure. So in my picture here, maybe the only difference is, say, that point right there is in C bar but not C, right? Maybe that's the only difference between C and C closure, say, something like that. So the key move here is just remembering that when you're computing closure in a subspace, it's the same as computing closure in the big space, except you just throw away any points that aren't in your subspace. So here I'm thinking of C as the smaller space and the subspace, and C bar is the bigger space. Okay. Now F is closed, and by the same argument, G is closed. Okay. And, A and B are disjoint, right? So that means, think about F and G. They must be disjoint too, because F is a subset of A, G is a subset of B. So F intersect G is a subset of A intersect B, which is empty. Okay, so F and G are disjoint. Moreover, we had A and B cover all of C closure. Now, when we shrink down to C, everything in C is either in A, in which case it's in F, or it's in B, in which case it's in G, right? Because everything in C is in C closure, and everything in C closure is in A or B. So if I write that slightly more formally, it would look like C is equal to, kind of trivially, it's equal to C closure intersects C, which is equal to A union B intersects C, and that is equal to what? Well, you could kind of distribute it, right? If you're in A or B, but you're also in C, then either you're in A and C, or you're in B and C. In other words, you're in F or you're in G. Okay. So F and G are closed, they're disjoint, and they cover C. So actually, so that means we've actually broken up this thing into two parts.
Okay, so now I better. Okay, so they're actually complements of each other, right? So C minus F equals G, and C minus G equals F. All right, we're not quite there yet. Because I haven't quite disconnected the space necessarily. There's one thing that I haven't taken care of in my proof here. And I assumed I had disjoint non-empty Clopen subsets of C and A and B, and now I'm trying to do, disjoint non-empty Clopen subsets of C closure, I call them A and B. And then from those A and B, I try and cook up this F and G, and I want them to be the same. I want them to be the same properties, disjoint, non-empty, and Clopen. Okay, so what have I got? Are they disjoint? Yes. Are they closed? Yes. And since they're complements of each other, they're also open. Okay. Because the complement of the closed set is an open set. So they're open, and let me emphasize, in C, right? In the subspace C. I mean, likewise, when I wrote here, when I wrote closed here, I mean in C, right? Okay. And there's this fourth property. A and B cover C closure. Likewise, F and G cover C. What's missing? What do I still need to show? What property from A and B have I yet to prove transfers to F and G? Yeah, they're disjoint. We've done that. That's right here, right?
Could it be non-empty?
Non-empty. So we have to show that when we shrunk down A to F and shrunk down B to G by throwing away possibly some limit points of C, we have to check that we didn't make F or G empty. Okay? Once we do that, then we'll be done. If we can show that they are non-empty, that will show that C is disconnected. And that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to prove the contrapositive. We wanted to prove that if your closure is a disconnected subspace, then already the original subspace was disconnected. Hence, flipping things around, if you have a connected subspace, then its closure is still connected. Okay. So that's what we have to check. Okay. So let's see. So C closure is equal to A. It's equal to F union G closure. Now, one of the key properties about the closure operator is that finite unions commute with it. Okay. Now, the closure of the empty set is always the empty set. Okay, so for example, if G is equal to the empty set, then G closure is equal to the empty set, which implies what? Which implies that C is actually just F closure. Now all of these closures here are computed in X, right? So to be clear here, that's what I'm getting. That's the main problem with the overline or over bar notation for the closure, is that although it saves a lot of space, sometimes it suppresses the context. So here we go. All right. By there. Okay, so C closure is F closure. All right. But C contains A contains F, right? C closure. Yeah. C closure contains A. F is a subset of A. Right. But we've shown that the closure of F, if we assume G is empty, then the closure of F is actually as big as the closure of C. Okay, so take closures of those three things. So what do you get? So you have C closure is the same as, you know, the closure of C closure has to be a superset of A closure, a superset of F closure, but this equals C closure if G is empty. But that means that actually A closure would then have to be C closure. So that means that if G was empty, then you would have C closure equal to A closure in X. And that would imply in turn, since A closure, or, you know, is, remember, A is actually a subset, a closed subset of C closure. That means that actually A, that would mean that closure of it computed in C closure of A would have to be the closure in X, right? So I'll write it again. But this is just C bar again. But that would imply that the. But remember, A is closed. If its closure relative to C closure is that, then actually that would mean that since A. That means you would have this but that would mean that B would be empty because A and B are disjoint subsets of C closure. So the way the argument works is
You're basically saying if one of the two pieces, say G, is empty, then the other piece is big enough to be dense, right? In the whole thing. So in other words, if F was dense in C, then it would also be dense in C bar. Hence, A would be dense in C bar. Right? So I guess I can write a few more words here. So, I mean, likewise, if you had if F was empty, then you'd get a similar argument that A is empty. So the way the argument works is you don't prove directly, oh, well, if... If G is empty, then B is empty. What you prove is that if the other piece, if say F is really big, then that means A has to be really big in a certain sense. So that's the intermediate stage. Right? Instead of dealing directly with emptiness, you deal with assuming in this case. The complement being dense subspace.
Somewhat
delicate. So A and B are not empty. So that means F and G. There was one additional theorem I was thinking about telling you about, but since we're at quitting time, I will write it up and just email you the theorem and proof that I wanted to tell you about next. I want to make sure you get it because I think it might be helpful for one of the homework problems. Okay. Any questions about this proof?
From the beginning, we let F to be C intersect of A, G is equal to C intersect B. I mean, why do we define like this?
Well, I need something that would inherit this. Basically, I want to show that if C bar is disconnected, then C is disconnected. So I say, okay, suppose I have sets that witness disconnectedness for C bar. Here's my recipe for cooking up sets that witness disconnectedness for C. And so the simplest recipe to try is, okay, throw C bar is a superset of C. So if you have things that disconnect C bar, just throw away everything that's not in C and hope that that will disconnect C, right? Like if this is the one point, say, that's in C bar but not in C, throw it away and see if what's left of A and what's left of B still disconnect the resulting smaller subspace, right? It's the simplest thing I could think of, right? Maybe you can think of something simpler, but if I have two disjoint Clopen subsets of a big space, C bar, and I want to get disjoint Clopen subsets of a smaller space, the natural thing to do is take these and then just shrink them by throwing away any points that aren't in my smaller subspace. So F becomes A minus that point. And maybe that was the only point I threw away, so G is the same as B. You can imagine there being lots of other points on here that you have to throw away. But the idea is just... just throw away the points you have to, but otherwise don't change A and B, because they seem to be doing a good job disconnecting C bar. Let's change them as little as possible. Hope they disconnect C after the change. So that was my strategy, and it worked. if you believe my proof, at least. And just try the simplest thing possible. You know, a lot of times that can lead you to a successful proof. That's called the greedy algorithm. Do whatever is easiest in the short term, and that's step one. And then step two, do whatever is, you know, the easiest thing next if you're not already done. So this was the simplest thing I could try, and I think it worked. If it didn't work, I would try something slightly more complicated. If I try, you know, six different things and none of them work, maybe the theorem is not true, and I should look for a counterexample, or I'm just not smart enough to prove it yet.